After really learning that the main use case of blockchain was this concept of an NFT, the next step for me was really just to dive into the communities and start asking questions. And what I found there and what I got really excited about is that this whole world of blockchain, it's all stemmed in curiosity, where there's not one person here who's an expert. And if they're saying they're an expert, stay away, because they're, you know for a fact that they don't know enough to be able to consider themselves an expert. So the fact that every community you go into, even today, even if someone has an ape or has spent millions of dollars in the NFT space, there's still something new and something innovative that's to come next week and the week after that. But I think the main message that I would give to anyone who's new to the Web3 space who wants to get involved is the only way to really understand this space is to get dirty. And the secrets are in the dirt. You gotta get down there and really understand it from the inside out.
What's up, guys? It's Deshaun Kaiser, former Notre Dame Irish quarterback, five-year NFL vet, and current founder and CEO of One of None. And this is The Game Plan.
Hey, faithful listeners, welcome back to The Game Plan with Jay Kapoor and Tim Cott. Every week, we share stories from pro athletes that help you raise your game in business and in life. And if you've forgotten the sound of my voice, well, I don't blame you. I am your host, Jay Kapoor, and it has been a little over a month since we put out our last episode. So very fair to ask, hey, Jay, where the heck have you been? The answer, my friends, is wedding planning. I wish I had a better answer than that. My beautiful fiance and I are getting married at the end of May. And over this past month, we've been working on finalizing all the important details for the big day. And if you're regular listeners of the show, you'll know that it's always more important to us to put out quality conversations with interesting guests rather than rushing out something that's half-assed. To that end, over the next month, we'll be coming down the home stretch of season 3 of The Game Plan. And with these remaining 5 episodes, we'll regroup this summer on how we continue telling the best athlete stories every week in the consistent, high-quality format that you've come to expect from The Game Plan. And today's show is certainly that. I have long been fascinated with collectibles. What it says about the human experience, what drives us to collect things, rare things, special things, things that we like to display and show off. And moreover, how is that changing in a world where things that we collect can now be purely digital and can be displayed not just on our mantelpiece, but on a digital shelf for everybody in the world to see? Well, today's episode focuses on the nature and psychology of digital collectibles with former NFL quarterback Deshaun Kaiser. A standout at Notre Dame, Kaiser had an up-and-down career in the NFL, playing for teams like the Cleveland Browns, Green Bay Packers, and the Oakland Raiders. He is now taking his experience as a former brand Jordan athlete and leveraging it into creating his own collectibles platform, One of None. Deshaun shares how he got into collecting himself, why he felt that calling to start his company, and even how his athletic career has prepared him for the many challenges of entrepreneurship. All right, with that said, let's dive into the psychology of collectibles with my guest today, Deshaun Kaiser, only on The Game Plan. All right, Deshaun Kaiser, welcome to The Game Plan.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome, man. Well, we are grateful to have you on today, not least of which because digital collectibles, digital art, sports collectibles, they seem to be some of the most popular topics that our listeners want us to get into with our athlete guests and really becoming more and more popular these days. Before we get into it, maybe let's start with you and your journey a little bit. You played in the NFL as a quarterback since 2017. Teams like the Browns, Packers, Raiders. You were also a finance major at Notre Dame. So when did you start thinking about life beyond football?
Contrary to most, the thought of life beyond football was much longer than football itself. In a sense that, my dad, I kind of refer to this story a lot. My dad, when I was 12, he was a police officer in Toledo, and I remember getting in the back of his car. On the way home, he would pick me up from school, and I mentioned not wanting to go to AAU practice. And he was like, son, there's really two options you have here, and it's either going to the military or you're getting a college scholarship to play sports. And obviously, I wasn't shooting anyone, and I was way too afraid to go to the military, so the thought behind sports for me at all times was around trying to, for it to be a means to something bigger. And so first was to, you know, get that college, you know, scholarship to go to a good university and get a degree and, you know, study amongst the best. But then from there, and now that I'm out of the league and starting to transition into that next level, and this has always been kind of the mission and the plan. So when you make a decision to go to a Notre Dame over an LSU or an Alabama or a USC, you know, that 40-year decision then is now obviously in effect now. So, and that thought about life after ball has kind of always been there in the back of the mind and kind of been preparing for it for a while.
I love asking that question initially because we get such a range of answers. I feel like for a lot of guys, especially the ones that play, you know, 10, 12 years, it almost gets harder every year. Every year that you're in the league, thinking about what comes after, your identity, your personality becomes so tied to football. Did you feel that for yourself? And as you're going through the transition now, is that identity something that you sort of have to grapple with, the two different sides of you, the football DeShone and the non-football?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because for me, there was still a bit of a transition that I had to make to being a, you know, a complete athlete going into the league, you know, and play multiple sports in high school. I get to Notre Dame. I'm studying finance. I'm, you know, taking internships in our 3-week off season to try to prepare for an opportunity to you know, get into finance in some sort of capacity, and then have this miraculous opportunity to get out in the field my redshirt freshman year and make the best of it. And then all of a sudden things kind of adjusted towards this idea of professional sports. So for me, I didn't really dive into being all ball and being, you know, really resonate with my own self as an athlete until maybe year two of the league. You know, year one with Cleveland, it was more teaching myself how to be all ball. You know, you go through all those GM meetings during pre-draft and they make all of these, you know, comments and questions around whether or not you're going to be like Brett Favre or be like Tom Brady or be like Aaron Rodgers in the sense of, you know, giving yourself to the game and being the first person in and the last person out. And while I knew all of that was in me, and the concept of being all ball all the time was still foreign to me at the time. I was still at the University of Notre Dame, where I still spent, you know, 50% of my time plus, you know, doing academics and thinking about finance. So it took me a year just to figure out what a professional athlete and what to be, you know, all ball was like. And then once I got, you know, kind of figured out what that was, had some help from Aaron Rodgers on trying to balance the kind of two lifestyles of thinking about things outside of football while also, you know, focusing in and being an all ball guy during the season, and finally figured that out. Now, it was kind of a tough time to figure it out because then you go from there, you get released in your second year with Green Bay, you end up with the Raiders, you're still trying to be an all ball guy. You end up getting released from there as Marcus Mariota gets signed, and now you end up, you know, with the Titans, and you're still trying to figure that out. So for me, that as much as it was definitely a transition to kind of change the way that I went about thinking about my day-to-day or how I communicate with people or what I'm going to do in my free time, you know, it was almost a sign of relief for me to be able to finally kind of take that piece out of it and just let myself be free and continue to explore kind of this business world.
I'm grateful to you and appreciate you sharing that story because I feel like resilience is a topic that comes up a lot when we talk to entrepreneurs, right? Everybody sort of thinks it's a rocket ship, it's all up and to the right. And in reality, it is sort of a constant day-to-day of, okay, new variables coming your way, changing. You know, you might have thought, okay, I'm going to have 2 more years at this location and suddenly, all right, now I'm moving across the country. I'm going somewhere else. And I think the idea of resilience that athletes have, just going through anything, whether it's injury, whether it's trades, whether it's getting cut, I think it applies so well to entrepreneurship. And so it's interesting to hear you tell that story and obviously what you're doing now, which we're going to talk about. Are there other traits that you feel like now that you're sort of in the entrepreneurial world that have carried with you from sports?
Yeah, you know, as a quarterback, I think the one thing that I keep in the back of my mind as I'm trying to lead a team and build a team around this idea and that I came across a couple years back, it's really, and one of the main things that I try to think about is in a locker room amongst a bunch of people from different backgrounds and they have, you know, different contracts and different at-home situations. As a quarterback, it's your job still to get in a huddle and get all of those, you know, 10 other guys in that huddle to believe in what you're saying and respect you for who you are, to be able to go out there and work for you in a way as that quarterback. You know, you are that voice of the coach onto the field. And if you can't find a way to relate with everyone in that group, it's really easy to feel that, and it's easy for a team to kind of fall apart. So that same kind of strategy of getting to know each person in that huddle, getting to know each person in that locker room and what makes them tick, is something that I try to keep in mind here, rather than thinking about trying to force everyone to think the way that I think and bring my football experiences into what they do. You know, everyone has a different background in this business, and everyone has a different set of circumstances. And the sooner me as a leader can learn where those circumstances stem from, the better than I can be at communicating and getting a job done when it comes time to execute on whatever that project might be.
For you, that project now is One of None. So talk to me a little bit about that. Where did One of None come from? Where does the name come from? And then what was your foray into Web3 and NFTs?
Yeah, so One of None really, you know, stemmed from an experience that I had with Brand Jordan as my on-field sneaker deal that I had in the league my first 3 years, in which I had this up-close and personal experience getting to understand how, this brand really focused in on this limited edition creation as a way to create brand awareness. In that 3 years, they activated heavy at Paris Fashion Week, and they went live and activated a bunch of collaborations with pop culture brands and entertainers and musicians to create these really collectible sneakers. And what I found during that experience was that, you know, this value that we were driving through scarcity, you know, this demand that we were driving through scarcity really was found more in the secondary market in terms of monetary value than it was in the primary. You know, we're only marking these shoes up 20, 30, maybe 40%. And then, you know, all of my friends are either on the sneakers app or standing up around the corner to get their hands on a pair of J's just to be able to flip on StockX or eBay. And that's where the real money kind of takes place on those collectibles. So the idea there and the problem that I found was that why are we driving demand through scarcity and when the value is found in a market that we have no attachment to as a brand? And so, you know, with that double circle, decided to really lean in on that and see if there was a way to connect the creators of limited edition products to that secondary market and effectively give a royalty back on each one of those exchanges. And while the original idea of One of None was completely Web 2, we were building for 8 months, 10 months, and we really kind of conceptualizing everything and modeling everything out before we ever even came near blockchain. And we found that blockchain, after the fact, was you know, the perfect solution to help us do exactly what we're set out to do, and that was connect the primary market to the secondary. And then in terms of the name, it's funny, the name almost happened before the business happened. I was sitting in my backyard, it was quarantine. I was one of those young guys that everyone was upset with in the early days. If I hopped on a flight to go back home, and you weren't supposed to leave the spot you're quarantining, and decided to get back home in Ohio, and I'm sitting in my parents' garage, essentially, and that's out back in the property we have. And I had this whiteboard, and I had that problem double circled. And the idea was that, hey, there's a select grouping of products out there in the world that are limited edition. You know, some are one of 1,000, some are one of 100,000, some are one of 10. And I had that up on the board. I, you know, put one of one, one of 10, one of 100, one of 1,000, and then ultimately, at the end, I had, you know, one out of however many X, you know, one over X. And it's like that, and that was kind of the original thought of this, is that as soon as you decide to number something, that kind of creates that demand. That's what creates that scarcity. And for us, that one over X then stayed up in the corner after I erased everything else, and it made it through a couple of different, you know, whiteboard sessions, and eventually became a logo. And while we were thinking of one of X to be the name, you know, we started to play with some other words, and that concept of one of None now is that while there are a lot of products out there that are limited edition, there's a select grouping of products that have this unbelievable opportunity to appreciate over time and become some of the biggest and most collectible assets in the game. And for those products, rather than being one of one or one of five, we consider those to be one of none.
This idea of, like, the psychology of collectibles has always been really interesting to me. And clearly, you know, for those that are listening, you won't see this, but those watching on YouTube will see that you've got a collection of I'm sure Jordans. I'm trying to read if I can. I mean, just a whole collection behind you. So clearly, you know, you're into the sneaker game. You've seen sneakerheads, but you also see, you know, digital art, car collectors. Have you thought about the sort of like human psychology of collecting? And in your mind, I mean, what is it? What is that joy of collecting really to you?
Well, I think that the beauty behind collecting virtually anything is that everyone has a different reason on why. And for me, you know, I grew up in a lower middle class home in West Toledo, you know, nothing special, nothing fancy. But my dad, as much as, you know, he worked his butt off to provide, you know, for my family. My mom was out working as well. He had his kind of things that he was into, and he was into shoes. And we had a classic car that sat in the garage. And while, you know, everything else around us was, you know, as kids, we never really felt the pressure and the work that he had to do to kind of have those items for himself to collect. You know, looking back on that now, you can only imagine the connection that he had to those items that he wanted to keep in great condition. So from that classic car out back to all these sneakers that were down in the basement, you know, on display. And, you know, his whatever his why is probably stems from his background and his experience of being able to, you know, to build a family and create a great job for himself. So for me, I think that my specific story now piggybacks off of that, where now seeing my dad have that desire to always have a fresh pair of sneakers on and to have a car to be working on in the backyard to, you know, take out on a Sunday cruise. That now is my way of saying, you know, I made it. You know, that's where my dad was heading. And now I have this ability through, you know, having the benefit of being a professional athlete early on and having a little financial freedom to go out and do some collecting. This is now my way of expressing myself, of saying, hey, while, you know, a lot of people get into video games and you know, their own hobbies, for me, I love classic cars and I love sneakers. And that's my thing. You know, once again, I think the beauty and the human psychology around collecting is that everyone has that little thing on why that was, you know, theirs, whether they were protecting it from their older brother and that's why they collected it underneath their bed, or whether they didn't have it and they really wanted it and they go out and they collect it over and over again to get that nostalgic moment of you know, finally having access to that item. I think that is the beauty of collecting, is that, you know, once again, everyone has a why.
For me, you know, I think the first, I guess, collecting hobby that I got into was probably like Pokemon cards.
Oh, yeah.
And the one thing that you didn't mention was it was a way to make friends, oh, yeah. Right? Because you would get together at somebody's house every Wednesday. Oh, man, I got a new pack. Like, I earned some money, you know, doing yard work. And I used that to buy a pack. And we would all open packs together. And it's, again, going back to being a kid, but it was a way to bond, right? A way to connect and a way to sort of share. And you start to see that now evolve in with digital communities and digital collectibles. And I think for folks that maybe didn't come from, you know, our generation, it's a little hard to wrap their mind around the digital aspect of it. So first, let's talk about digital communities. I mean, where does this idea of a community around collectibles come from? And what are some of the interesting things that either you've done or you've seen other communities do around building, you know, digital networks around collectibles?
For me, once again, my collecting experience started in sneakers and it dabbled into classic cars. I got, you know, three classic cars now. In those worlds, and there's this community that is built in the physical space that typically is, you know, this biker club or this classic car club in your local area. You get that type of community there. The sneakerheads, most likely, yeah, in order to get your hands on these sneakers, there's only three or four outlets in town. And in that, you kind of get to shake hands with some other people who are aligned with you. But as we continue to move towards this more globalized world and this interconnected world that we have using the internet, I think that the closer we get to a metaverse and the closer we get to the ability to, you know, connect with anyone around the world at any point in time, the more there is a desire to find other people out there who are like you. So for those folks who aren't willing to get up and go shake hands with that person that they bump into at the sneaker shop, this becomes now this more accessible way of kind of exploring in your own space with your own comfort, to find other people that are like you. And now this concept of, you know, NFTs and blockchain kind of brings that to a whole new level. While, you know, the original communities that I was a part of are, you know, the AIM communities that then becomes MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, Reddit, Discord. You know, as we now climb into this more, you know, digital world, I believe that there's even more of a desire to find other people in that space that are like you. And to have this asset now being this blockchain backed token or this blockchain backed piece of art or profile photo or whatever it may be that you're collecting. Now you get to bring this whole new element of incentivizing through making money. And there's the simple concept that I can sit in my comfort, in my home, around my people, yet connect with a lot of other people that are just like me, but then also have this ability to monetize off of that. It's like it's bringing that community, that teamwork that we've kind of grew up with, outside and as our generation moves to this more digitized world, it now takes that same kind of vibe and brings it into a whole new style of community. And that's that digital one that you're speaking of.
And you guys are something interesting around hybrid NFTs where it's tied a digital, you know, on the blockchain collectible tied to a physical asset. That's pretty unique. Explain that to me. You know, how does that work? Do I get to hold the physical item? What are the physical items? Walk me through that. If I wanted to get one of these hybrid NFTs, what's the process?
Awesome. Yeah. So yeah, you know, at the core of One of None, what we are is a vaulting infrastructure that can take physical products and mint them onto the blockchain. And from that, having that, you know, one-to-one relationship or that soul-bound relationship between a physical asset and digital allows collectors to have this new experience of being able to use the digital asset in the metaverse and exchange that good seamlessly and using these Web3 exchanges that are out wallet to wallet, but also have that conventional value and that conventional understanding of the physical world that we're all coming from into this new Web3 space. So for us, the way our platform works is that connection that we make between the good is found in the vault. And the way it works is while the token will always sit in your wallet to represent your ownership, while the physical good is vaulted with us, you have the ability to freely exchange that using either our secondary exchange or any other Web3 exchange that's Ethereum compatible. But the moment you decide to redeem the physical good out of the vault, we put a non-transfer on your token using the safe transfer part of the protocol that stops you from passing on that NFT. With the idea that if we hand you both at the same time, there's no stopping you from selling the physical and hold on to the digital or trying to sell the digital and hold on to the physical. So in order to keep that marriage, to have this ability to take redeem products and allow the NFT to not be transferred during that time allows us to get that true total lifetime value of that good. And because the way that you then are able to exchange the NFT is to send the physical good back in to us, we'll authenticate it, grade it, put it back into storage. And once we identify it to be that unique product that we sent out in the first place, we now take that non-transfer off of the token and allow you to go pass it on. So while other, you know, C2C, secondary marketplaces that exist are really only in that physical product's life for a short period of time, whether they defaulted it or not, you know, our goal is to really track that true total lifetime value of that good as it goes both in and out of the vault, you know, into the physical world and not, but then also tracking those digital transactions as well as it bounces from wallet to wallet.
And where does the monetization for the creator come in? Because where we started the conversation was, hey, if you're the brand, you know, that is the creator of the shoe, once that makes it to the secondary market, you don't see any of that upside.
Exactly.
If I design a one-of-one, you know, t-shirt or hat, how do I see that value grow in perpetuity?
Exactly. So you know, with the main premise of the business to be to connect that creator into the secondary market by running this hybrid model in those products, what we can do now is input right into that smart contract of the NFT a royalty that every time that NFT exchanges, 6% on our platform and then 4% on any of the other Web3 platforms is going back to the original creator. That gives them that perpetual access to a royalty that in my opinion they deserve. You know, you've seen StockX and eBay and all of these other secondhand places that have grown to be billion-dollar corporations off the heels of creations from, you know, big brands and big artists and athletes that are getting exchanged on their platforms that they get to monetize off of. And now by, you know, putting this model in these goods and helping launch new hybrid assets into the marketplace, we now allow these physical creators like artists, you know, athletes, entertainers, and then these brands that are really making a lot of these new limited edition products, and they now can benefit from obviously that lifetime value in those secondary transactions.
Yeah, it is. It's unique because vaulting has been around, and sort of the digital assets have been around, but I think you guys bringing them together is what was actually what caught my eye initially when you and I first chatted. I think of something like StarStock, which does this for trading cards, right? You don't want to keep them because, hey, if something happens, flooding at your house, tens of thousands of dollars lost, and unless you're actively looking at your cards every day, probably better to keep them somewhere safe, right? But I don't think anyone, I don't know, it could be different from what I've seen, is allowing you to create a digital, you know, token with it. At the same time, you know, what I really like about this is that it's more accessible. Tying it to a physical item is, in a way, allowing folks, as you were saying, not of our generation, to still have the comfort and safety of knowing that it's tied to something, as opposed to just saying, you know, you sort of hear a lot of people with these profile pictures say, oh, well, I can right-click save your profile picture. You know, who owns it? And it's this idea of sort of authenticating ownership that I think is really unique. Where did that come from? What was sort of the hook behind, you know, vaulting really being the crux of the business?
Well, you know, as we dove into blockchain and started doing our research, once again, we tried to find as many ways as we could to connect that physical good to the digital. And every model that we you know, researched had this unbelievable opportunity to separate the two. Like, if I hand you both at the same time, there's just nothing telling me that I'm not going to try to bring a fake in and pass them together, or I'm going to sell one and keep the other. So by putting the vault as the center, the middleman between you and that next transaction, we now can give you this authentic product, this guaranteed authenticity that collectors, in my opinion, that's all they're really looking for. That's why they trust in StockX. The moment that StockX can't, you know, give you an authentic product is the moment you will no longer go there. So for us, we wanted to, you know, guarantee that authenticity. But then also, from day one, even before blockchain, we really focused in on this concept of how do we build this digital life for this good. A big quality that we saw in a lot of these one of none caliber of products was, you know, who owned it and what did they do with it? You know, if Drake wears the Virgil Abloh watch courtside at a game, while that watch was already really expensive, it just became a lot more expensive because now Drake is, you know, at a playoff game and he has it on his wrist, and you know that now further enhances the value of the good. Well, as we move towards this more digital, you know, life, and everyone's looking to kind of show off their collections and show off their products in the digital space, our goal originally was how can we track all of those different moments and bring it to that physical product to further the value, enhance the value. And whether there's wear and tear on the good or not, I think that true provenance is valuable to any collector that's out there. So to now bring that over to the blockchain, the only way to be able to really understand how this product is being experienced and how this product is wearing down is to have that center location being the vault as a way of connecting it to that physical good. So as those goods come in and out, we now are tracking that ownership. We're grading that product 1 to 5. We're taking notes on each one of those goods, and then from there, we're providing this Carfax in a way for every product that we launch as that product comes in and out of the vault.
And so right now, it's a lot more like a managed marketplace model. Is the goal to eventually become sort of true open marketplace? Any creator anywhere can design, or are you still very much trying to curate because that value comes from exclusivity and curation You know, what's the longer term vision look like?
You got it. Exclusivity is really one of the main traits. Once again, if you're trying to define those products that have that ability to appreciate over time, and you're trying to figure out what are the qualities within those goods and that make us as collectors, you know, want to desire those products. A lot of that has to do with exclusivity. You know, the lower the count, the cooler the person that owned it before you, the more collectible that good is. So this model really only works around goods that have this secondary value. If things are depreciating at a consistent rate, now we're stuck with a bunch of dead storage on goods that just have no value. So it's really important that every product we launch does have the ability to you know, be exchanged and continue to appreciate. And then the second piece there is that by launching new products with this curated set of creators, it's really important that we can authenticate those goods, as I mentioned before. So it's important that the amount of effort and time and resources that go into authenticating a good, so that's the RFID that's placed in or on the product, that's the NFC tag, that's the invisible ink, that's the spectrometer reader to check the Pantones or the colors, whatever it may be, that costs, you know. And so to be able to run that model and have that inventory management around a good typically needs to be something that's at a high price point and, you know, very quality. And therefore, you know, curating is really important for us to make sure that the products we have are those, you know, one of none quality.
And you mentioned earlier on that this initially started as a Web 2 idea that sort of moved into Web 3 and on the blockchain. I'm more curious for, you know, our listeners that are working in quote unquote Web 2 right now and seeing all the activity and action that's happening around creator economy and Web 3, you know, what were some of the ways that you educated yourself and really leaned into learning about this, you know, making that transition from Web 2 to Web 3?
Well, you know, at the time, I didn't have one friend in Web 3. You know, there was a couple guys that I was talking to at Notre Dame who were finance majors, and, you know, they're hearing the term blockchain that was around, but no one really understood it too much. So I didn't really have too many resources. I didn't have that guy that I could reach out to and ask a bunch of questions to. So my exploration was purely down the you know, the typical 2020s rabbit hole of YouTube, where, you know, you start you know, on one video and they suggest the next and they suggest the next, and just like most, I was just completely caught off guard with the fundamentals that instantly changed in my mind of how business and how community building would be done when you can incentivize someone with this, you know, blockchain based token. And then on top of that, to have that blockchain be decentralized and public, just this new set of standard you know, the transaction there. So for me, and diving into that space, one was one, you know, all YouTube, and I didn't really have too many friends. But then two, after really learning that the main source of blockchain and the main use case of blockchain was this concept of an NFT. And the next step for me was really just to dive into the communities and start asking questions. And what I found there and what I got really excited about is that this whole world of blockchain is all stemmed in curiosity, where there's not one person here who's an expert. And if they're saying they're an expert, stay away, because they you know for a fact that they don't know, you know, enough to be able to consider themselves an expert. So the fact that every community you go into, even today, even if someone, you know, has an ape or has spent, you know, millions of dollars in the NFT space, there's still something new and something innovative that's to come next week and the week after that. If I could have told you what, you know, what we thought of one of none 6 months ago, after spending, you know, 8 months in the space, and now what we think of one of none now, it's completely changed, you know, and there's a new demand and there's so much innovation that's happening that we're trying to apply that to what we're doing. So the only way to really understand that is to get in the community and ask those same questions that everyone else is asking. And you next thing you know, you start to build that little community around yourself. So if you're into day trading and, you know, smaller price point products, there's plenty of those people that are willing to answer those questions for you. If you're into, you know, the long-term play and aping in and going after something big, there's also a lot of people in that space who can, you know, you can piggyback off of and learn from. But I think the main message that I would give to anyone who's new to the Web3 space, who wants to get involved, is the only way to really understand this space is to get dirty. You know, the secrets are in the dirt. You gotta get down there and really understand it from the inside out. And because there's no way to put a graph up on the board or a set of metrics on a market that's so young, to be able to make those valuation decisions. The decisions really need to be found in that community and with that founding team and with those holders, and to be able to determine if that true value is going to stay or eventually appreciate.
I think it's great feedback. And I think, it's this idea of until you have skin in the game, you say this as an investor, right? It's all fun and games to play a fantasy stock portfolio, but until you've got real money on the line, you're not doing the same level of diligence. You're not thinking twice about, jumping into something you don't understand. To the same point, right? If you're trying to really get immersed in this, it doesn't mean put tens of thousands of dollars down on something you don't understand, but start small, right? Lean in, get into these communities. Sure, buy an NFT or buy a coin and see how it appreciates, see what makes it move. It's kind of the same thing. It's the same thing that if you were being a stock picker and you're trying to learn about equities, it's really not that dissimilar. Am I simplifying it too much?
No, I think that's exactly it. I like to tell anyone, it's like, any of my investment decisions, whether it's in stocks, whether it's in real estate, whether it's in NFTs, and I hold myself to the same standard on the quality of the investment I'm getting ready to make. If I'm going to go invest into a new startup, which essentially a lot of these NFT projects are just startups, you're going to spend time with the founder and you have to make a decision as an investor of whether or not you are, you believe in that founding team to be able to get it done. And more importantly, do you believe that founding team knows what they don't know so they can find other people to get involved to get that done? And if you can't get that conviction with that investment, you typically don't get involved. Well, the same way that you would, put that money into a startup is the same way you have to evaluate these NFT projects because they are startups. This is a long-term play. It's all about the roadmap. It's all about the community and being able to grow. So if you don't trust that founding team, whether they're doxed or anonymous, and those experiences you do get with them, if you don't believe that they can accomplish the mission that community set out to accomplish, or that community is following that mission, then typically it's not a good play. So the way that I'd like to do that is pop in on a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, where it's just a normal day, and see what the conversation's about. If it's about that mission that community set out to go after, it's probably a good chance that they're going to be around for a while trying to accomplish that. But if you're getting in there and they're shilling the next project and, pissed at gas wars and talking about, the next, big drop that's getting ready to happen, it's probably going to be a cash grab and it's just less likely of a chance for it to actually go up in value. And so I tried to apply that same type of mentality and questioning to the NFT projects I get involved in as well.
No, I appreciate that feedback. I guess flipping it back to now building a company, what's been the hardest part of entrepreneurship for you? What's been the most challenging part of this journey so far?
The biggest challenge that I've had as an entrepreneur is understanding that there isn't anyone there to tell you to take a break. In football and basketball and in baseball, basketball and baseball back in high school, and then obviously football into the pros, there's this understanding amongst all athletes that you have to recover in order to play, especially in football. I mean, we play, in the NFL, you play 17 weeks. And out of those 17 weeks, there's only 17 days of real action. 90% of your time outside of those 17 days are actually spent recovering, not practicing. That's what people kind of miss there. And that understanding then as an athlete allows you to realize that in an off season day, I can only work out for 3, maybe 4 hours. And maybe I go home and I'll open up my playbook. But it's really important to get that rest and that recovery. Well, you now switch over and try to become an entrepreneur and you want to apply that same determination and that same resilience to building your business. And no one tells you to take a break, and no one gives you a warning. And my laptop's always down here on this desk for me to come downstairs and continue to work. And so trying to find a way to kind of manage my time, manage my emotions, manage my relationships, manage, my family. Those are the things that are becoming the most difficult for me, because especially as you're trying to prepare just to get launched, once we launch, who knows what actually operating the business will be like. And, it's easy to kind of set your schedule to give yourself some time in there. But when there's an objective that's sitting out in front of you and there's a timeline to that launch. And then there's this finite amount of money that you've raised that's just slowly dwindling down to that zero number. And there's always that pressure to get downstairs and keep going. And it's about, you know, finding a way to take in a lot of what you're doing from professional sports and, you know, having that resilience while also understanding that without someone there to tell you to take a break, you got to be able to do that on your own and find your own breaks as well.
Appreciate the openness, especially about the journey of building the company. I think that's what, you know, especially the entrepreneurs that listen to our show, I think they'd love to hear that because it's a lonely road, honestly, right? And hearing somebody like you, yeah, you know, made it to the pros, did all these amazing things. You're going through these challenges yourself. It makes it feel less lonely. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I've been diving in the last week, listening, you know, trying to catch up and listen to JJ talk and Paulo Ono and what you're building is awesome, man. There's a lot of people who've,
I appreciate that,
you know, especially from athletes who see the success of Bussing with the Boys and, you know, all these different podcasts out there that they think they can dive in and attack things from a business angle. But I think that the overall message that everyone that comes onto your show has is one that's more rooted in business than it is in sports. And I yeah. think that that's typically tough as a host or tough as a show in general, to be able to, you know, find one enough athletes who value that. But then two, you know, there's so many moments to ask about that big play, to ask about that moment back in college, to ask about that championship game, that big moment that most people would, you know, get on a podcast and that would be their list of questions is all these, you know, these sports related questions. But, you know, I really respect what you've been able to build and excited that, you know, you're able to have me on. This is awesome.
I'm grateful for you saying that. It's, you know, it's a project of passion. And ultimately to me, I think it's about showing the full side, you know, that sort of full experience, because I think Apollo said it, right? He's like, you train 4 years for that one moment on the podium, and then you got to wait 4 more years for it. The person you are is not built in that one Olympic race. The person you are is built in the, you know, 4 years and 11 months that it takes to get there. And so that's the story that I like to tell. But, you know, what I would like entrepreneurs to take away from our conversation is just that it is okay to give yourself that permission to be a full person, right? Because ultimately, it's not about how fast can you move for the least amount of time. It's about staying in the game. It's about having that longevity. And I'm grateful that, you know, you have found that self-realization to say that in order to bring your best self to what you're doing at work, you have to bring your best self to the rest of life as well. So, you know, we love that. Deshaun, thank you so much for sharing your experiences here on The Game Plan today.
Thank you very much. This is awesome.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of The Game Plan. As always, thanks so much for listening. A few quick shout outs before you go. First off, a huge thanks to my guest, Deshaun Kaiser, for joining me to chat about the psychology of collecting and his foray into entrepreneurship with his company, One of None. Our thanks to our editor, Emmanuel Maestri, and to Neil Kulkarni for packaging and promoting this content. Our theme song is called Champ by Stuart Moore. Hey, did you know that you can watch as well as listen to The Game Plan? Head over to our YouTube page for lots of great video content in addition to full episodes in video form. Lastly, if you're still listening, you must really love The Game Plan. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes when you have a chance. It really means a lot. Well, that's all for now. We'll see you next time on The Game Plan.